Hey guys, welcome to Cracked. I'm your host, Christina Tucker. I will be flying solo this week, but don't worry, Jen will be back for the next one. Today we have a very unique episode that I'm super excited for. I don't have a case for you, but I have something that you may end up liking even more. As I'm sure some of you know, I am obsessed with criminal profiling, and yes, I love Criminal Minds, but that is not what I'm talking about. I mean real-life criminal profiling. Looking at the personality traits of killers and murderers alike and breaking down what makes them tick. And before we jump in, I want to make one quick note that I will be using past serial killers as a behavioral model, and there will be pictures on our website if you want to follow along with who I'm talking about. So let's get started. I want to start off with the basics for anyone who doesn't know what I'm talking about. Criminal profiling is what advanced investigators, typically those who work for the FBI, use to catch serial criminals, whether that be killers, rapists, bombers, or anything else of the sort. They do this by analyzing past offenders and taking their behavioral traits and applying them to unknown subjects. If you've watched Criminal Minds, I know you're familiar with the term unsub. Now, until doing some research recently, I thought this was only in movies, but as it turns out, unsub is a real thing. An unsub is what police call an unknown or unidentified subject. This means the person committing the crime who has not yet been caught. Anyway, they look at characteristics of previous criminals and use that information to predict helpful insight into the killer at large. Whether that be social behavior patterns, geographic location, or any relationships, job, or status that could be beneficial to the investigation. The first thing I want to talk to you guys about is the 6-step process to building a criminal profile. Step 1 is called profile inputs. This is when investigators will gather and organize all relevant information pertaining to the case. That can be a large range of things, but typically you'll see a detailed report of the criminal investigation, crime scene photos, a description of the area in which the crime occurred, the medical examiner or ME's report, a timeline of the victim's movements immediately prior to death, and a detailed profile of the victim. Now the last part, the profile of the victim, often makes people scratch their head. Like, why do we need to analyze someone who is already dead? Well, the reason for this is because most often, killers will have a specific type of victim that they kill. For instance, Ed Kemper killed young college co-eds, while Jack the Ripper killed prostitutes. And you may be asking, well yeah, but Christina, why does that matter? Well, it matters because you can tell a lot about the killer based on who he kills. For example, if all the victims are successful businessmen in relationships, one might assume that the killer is a male who feels he was robbed of his chance at success in some way and he isn't able to be the kind of guy that he should be able to be. Okay, so moving on. Step 2 is called constructing a decision process model. This is where crucial details and characteristics of the homicide are established. These details would include things such as whether the murder was a serial murder or if it was a one-time kill. You also would determine if murder was the primary objective or if it was a side effect to an alternative plan. Another very key factor would be if the victim is high or low risk. A high-risk victim is often described as someone who sometimes wouldn't be reported missing right away and would be easy to approach. This would be your homeless people, a prostitute, or maybe even a junkie. A low-risk victim, however, is a person that would immediately be reported missing and are often not easy to approach. This would be businessmen, happily married couples, or even your model high school students. Another thing you want to consider in this step is if the victim was killed at the crime scene or if they were killed elsewhere and placed at the crime scene. And if that's the case, where were they killed? So step 3 is called the crime assessment. Now this step is definitely the most involved out of the 6. In this phase, detectives will determine if the crime scene has traits of an organized or disorganized killer. I'll explain those in a minute, so just bear with me. The idea of classifying serial homicide crime scenes is attributed to Roy Hazelwood, FBI agent and profiler. Factors you want to consider when classifying a crime scene are as follows. Was the victim's body positioned by the killer? Were there sexual acts performed before or after death? Was there cannibalism or mutation involved? And so on. These factors allow investigators to determine if the killer is organized or disorganized. Organized killers premeditate and carefully plan every detail of their crime. This results in little evidence being found at the crime scene. These killers are often antisocial but are definitely not insane. They show no remorse at all. Organized killers have an above average intelligence and are usually decently attractive. They will typically be married or live with a domestic partner. Most of the time, they are educated, employed, skilled, controlling, and charming. They usually can talk or seduce their victims into capture. Typically, with an organized killer, you will have three crime scenes. There will be a spot where the victim was approached, one where they were killed, and one where the body was dumped. These killers are hard to catch because they cover their tracks so well. They often have basic forensic knowledge and they will follow the media and news reports about their crimes. A few examples of an organized killer would be Ted Bundy, Dennis Rader, who's often referred to as the BTK, and Gary Ridgway, or the Green River Killer. Disorganized killers, however, are the exact opposite. They don't plan their kills very well, and they leave all sorts of evidence behind. They make no attempt to hide the body. They are often younger, mentally ill, and/or a drug or alcohol addict. They most often lack poor social and communication skills and have a below-average intelligence. Sometimes they will come from a dysfunctional or abusive family. They can also be sexually impotent, but crave sex, which often leads to a very disturbing death for the victim. Disorganized killers are isolated and alone, and they often are confused during and after the killing. Most of the time, they lack a transportation method, which typically will lead investigators to believe that the killer lives closer to the crime scene. A blitz attack, or like a sneak attack, is what disorganized killers do to kidnap their victim. A good example of a disorganized killer would be Jack the Ripper. And sometimes, rarely, but sometimes, you will have a mix of both types. This is usually the result of one of two things. The first being that you have two different offenders. A dominant and submissive partnership is the most common way of having both types. The other way would be if the unsub was undergoing a psychological transformation during his kill period. He could be escalating and becoming more organized, or he could be devolving and beginning more frenzied. The fourth step is the actual criminal profile itself. This is where profilers produce a report for local law enforcement that predicts personality, physical, and social characteristics of the unsub. This report will list any items that the killer may have in his or her possession, and it will explain any tactics for how to identify, apprehend, and question the subject at hand. The fifth step is the investigation. This is where local law enforcement will incorporate the profile into their strategy of catching the killer. They will narrow down their suspect list as well. If there are more murders that occur, that information will be provided to the file in this stage. The first case where a murder profile was used was the Atlanta child murders in the early 80s. This profile was created by John Douglas and Roy Hazelwood. Now, quick side note, I own like three of John Douglas's books and they are so good. If you are interested in what we're talking about in this episode, I would totally recommend them. My favorite is The Killer Across the Table, but I also have Mindhunter and Anatomy of a Motive, and they are all so good. So please listen to them if you're interested. Anyway, the FBI sent their profilers down to Atlanta to develop a profile with local law enforcement to catch the killer. The sixth and final step is apprehension. This is what investigators call the, quote, proof of performance step. If the profile was created well, then everything in this step will prove that. This is where they caught the Atlanta child murderer, so the profile did prove quite useful in this case. The result of each successful profile is added to the database at Quantico, and they use special algorithms to increase the accuracy of their profiling ability. So now that we've covered the basics, I want to talk to you about the four main types of serial killers. A serial killer, for those of you who want the formal definition, is a person who commits a series of murders, often with no apparent motive and typically following a characteristic, predictable behavioral pattern. The first type of serial killer is what investigators call a power and control killer. These killers experience sexual gratification from dominating their victim. They are most often sociopathic and they live by their own rules. Some examples of this kind of killer would be Gary Ridgway, John Wayne Gacy, and Dennis Rader. The second type of killer would be called a visionary killer. These people are compelled by so-called voices or visions. They are psychotic and are most often compelled to kill a certain type of people. An example of this type of killer would be David Berkowitz, otherwise known as the Son of Sam. The third type of killer is what we call mission-oriented killers. They feel a need or duty to kill a certain type of person. Most commonly, they will go after people of a certain religion, race, or a very common group is prostitutes. They often feel as though they were cleaning up a mess or ridding the world of a burden. An example of this type of killer would be Joseph P. Franklin. The fourth kind of serial killer is called a thrill seeker. They can also be referred to as a hedonistic killer or sometimes a lust killer. These people feel a very strong connection between personal violence and sexual gratification, meaning that they receive sexual pleasure from killing these people. They are sadistic killers and will often take their time during the actual kill. These are the types of killers who are often portrayed in TV shows and movies. One example of this type of killer would be Israel Keyes. One other thing I want to discuss with you guys is the difference between sociopaths and psychopaths. Often people will use them interchangeably, but they are not the same thing. Doctors don't officially diagnose someone as a socio or psychopath, so that can make it harder to differentiate the two. They typically will be classified as having an antisocial personality disorder. Psychopaths and sociopaths do have personality. What the hell did I mean by that? Psychopaths and sociopaths have similar personality traits, however. They both have a poor inner sense of right and wrong, and they are extremely unempathetic. A psychopath does not have a conscience. This means that if they steal or lie, they feel absolutely no guilt whatsoever. They may pretend to feel guilty by analyzing the behavior of others so they aren't, quote, found out, but they really do not empathize. A sociopath, on the other hand, does have a conscience, but it is incredibly weak. They know that stealing is wrong, for example, but it doesn't stop them from doing it. They both lack empathy, but a psychopath has no regard for other people and treats them like objects that can be used for some sort of personal gain. Most socio and psychopaths are not violent, but they use, quote, manipulation and reckless behavior, end quote, to meet their desires. They both are very cold and quite calculating as well. People often refer to sociopaths as hot-headed. They are less able to act empathetic, and they make it known that they do not care. They often blame others for their behavior, and they do not think about how others will be affected by their actions. Psychopaths, on the other hand, are described as cold-hearted. They are harder to recognize because they mimic the behavior of others, and they are very intelligent. They are very calculating, and they plot out their every move. You may be wondering how this pertains to profiling. Most killers fall into one of these two categories, and it is essential to recognize these behaviors because it can help investigators predict the actions of the killer. Now, I do want to emphasize that not all sociopaths and psychopaths are killers. You may know someone who exhibits these traits and they do not kill people. Hopefully. Just kidding. But seriously, they don't have to be killers. They are just traits to look out for. Some examples of a psychopath would be Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer, and Harold Shipman. Sociopaths, in my opinion, are a little bit more difficult to identify, but one good example would be John Wayne Gacy. I also believe that Robert Chambers from our Preppy Murder episode was a sociopath, even though he was not diagnosed. He displayed all of the characteristics, and he did turn out to be a killer. If you want a really good example of a sociopath, go watch the Criminal Minds episode, A Shade of Grey. It is season 4, episode 22. It chills me to the bone every time I watch it, and I don't get freaked out easily. I don't want to give away too much, so you'll have to go watch for yourself, but trust me, you'll be spooked. That just about wraps up our show for today. I want to reiterate one thing, though. We do this show to educate our listeners on how hard people in the criminal justice field work and to see the work that needs to be done to ensure that justice is served. The people who commit these heinous crimes deserve nothing but life in prison. And the more people we can educate, the more killers we can put behind bars. I hope that some of you are interested in going into the criminal justice field, and I hope that listening to this show gives you a glimmer of hope in knowing that the guilty are brought to justice and hope prevails. I want to thank you guys for listening today. We will be taking the Instagram poll from a few weeks back into consideration for our next case, so stick around to see if the case that you picked won. We may do another episode like this in the future if you guys are interested, so please let us know what you think. Please be sure to give us a follow on Instagram at cracked.crime.podcast and Twitter at crackedcrime. You can also visit us on our website, which is linked in our bio. Feel free to send us an email with any case suggestions or questions regarding the episode at crackedcrimepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much, and be sure to tune in next time for Cracked.